Welcome to Knowing Your Way, a Princess Margaret Ovarian Cancer podcast. I'm your host, Alicia Sarabia. I'm a physician and I am a patient with ovarian cancer receiving care at Princess Margaret Hospital. Today we'll be presenting part one of a two-part series on palliative and end-of-life care. This episode will focus mostly on the physical complications of ovarian cancer. Many of these occur during the entire journey of a woman's experience with ovarian cancer, including at the very end stages. And part two will focus on the emotional and psychological aspects of the very end of life. With us today is Dr. Brevany Hannon, the Chair of Palliative Care at Princess Margaret and the Research Lead for Palliative Medicine in the Department of Medicine and Family Medicine. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Brevany.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so off the top, before we get into the scenarios that might arise when ovarian cancer gets complicated in patients, why don't we talk about palliative care, what exactly we mean by that, and why it's important to introduce palliative care early on in the healthcare journey of women suffering from this disease?
You know, this is a bit of a passion project of mine to talk about early palliative care. It's what a lot of my research is in. So I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to maybe dispel some myths about that today, because I think a lot of people still equate palliative care with the very end of somebody's life, right? When they're coming to the end of life, when maybe their treatment has stopped, and perhaps they're in a very ill or dire situation. And there's been a lot of work done over the past 10 to 15 years to show that palliative care teams, when they get involved in patients' care earlier in the illness course, even from the time of diagnosis of advanced cancer, have a really important role to play and can really enhance patients' experiences and outcomes. And there's been some research done by our team at Princess Margaret and in other centers that have shown that when a palliative care team gets involved earlier in the illness course, along with your oncologist and the rest of your team, it can have really tangible benefits. So it can improve your quality of life, your satisfaction with the care that you receive, your symptoms, and in some cases, it can actually help people to live for longer, which almost seems counterintuitive when you think of the role of palliative care.
Yeah, that really caught my eye when I read a little bit up in preparation for this, that actual duration of life, or survival, I guess, increases when palliative care is introduced. Give us maybe an example or two of how palliative care can influence the outcomes that you've discussed, please.
Well, you know, our real kind of skill set is around managing symptoms. And again, our research has borne this out. The patients have told us that when they received palliative care alongside their regular cancer care, they felt that they had more, you know, detail-oriented attention to their symptoms. We all know how busy oncology clinics are and how hard it is to get through all of these different topics. In the palliative care clinic, you've got a lot more time and space to really delve deeply into your symptoms and come up with a more personalized approach to your care than just the sort of the surface level assessment and management. And so we're really trying to tailor the symptom control to the individual patient and their family and their circumstances. And of course, when you're feeling better, then that allows you to do a lot of things that make you happy, right? You've got better quality of life if you're not in pain, if you're feeling stronger, if you're able to spend that time with your family and do the things that are important to you. It also gives you a chance to think about the future in a more thoughtful and, you know, elongated way. So another skill that the palliative care team has been shown to bring to the mix is to give patients and their families, you know, the time and the space to talk about the future, to talk about any fears they might have outside of that regular care team that they have with their oncologist, which of course has to be very focused on, you know, your treatment plan and your scans and your blood work and all of that, which is a crucial component. But being able to speak to a team that's a little bit at arm's length from the day-to-day delivery of your care, being able to maybe talk about some of the fears or worries you have about the future, what that might look like for you and your family, and to start having conversations about what might happen and how you might like your care to be delivered as you approach the end of life, really empowers patients to make those decisions and take some of the pressure off their families when the time comes. So I think all in all, what we're seeing is we're trying to help patients in the moment and their families to feel better, to address their symptoms and to feel more prepared and more empowered for the future.
Yeah, that all sounds very good. You mentioned families and caregivers a few times in your explanation, and of course we can't forget what duress families and caregivers experience during this time. So if you can alleviate some of that for them as well, then that's obviously a very healthy thing. I was thinking about palliative care in the context of ovarian cancer, and knowing that women may often present late in the course of their disease, how does that factor in with palliative care? So is it a problem? Is it manageable?
For sure, it's manageable. But I think, you know, oftentimes when you get diagnosed, there's such a flurry of appointments and new faces and new people and new team members that any patient is dealing with, it can just be very overwhelming. And it's hard to try and figure out where what is the optimal time to bring the palliative care team in there, because of course we don't want to overwhelm patients by saying here's another person and another team of people, but nor do we want to leave it too late that you know you're not getting that benefit and that advantage. So I mean, the good news is usually the oncology team works really closely with the palliative care team. We have a very close relationship with our gynecological oncology colleagues, and you know, they have an excellent skill set in managing, you know, the basic symptoms and getting started on a treatment regimen. And then once the dust settles, then they tend to introduce us when things have settled down a little bit. But, you know, the care is really very coordinated between the two teams. And I think that's something to just reinforce, is that it is a team-based effort and allows everybody to sort of speak to their strengths and to play to their strengths and to work together to give patients the best possible outcomes. And you're right, with ovarian cancer, it is often a little bit later because of the nature of the illness and how it presents itself and how vague the symptoms can be. So mm-hmm. I think those conversations with the oncologist, you know, sometimes happen a little bit sooner maybe than they would with other types of cancer. But we also have patients who themselves will advocate for palliative care, which is incredible. And having that ability to go to your oncologist and go, hey, do you think it would be helpful for me to see a palliative care doctor or a team at this point, is also very welcome.
Okay, that's a good tip. One more thing about our discussion, like specifically on palliative care. I think some folks get a little confused when we talk about providing chemotherapy at the, you know, at the very, towards the end of life almost. We call palliative chemotherapy, I think. You can confirm that. Can you explain why this may be appropriate and necessary in certain situations?
Yeah, you know, on the one hand, we want to make sure that we're not giving, you know, potentially toxic and difficult to manage treatment when patients are very close to the end of life, because oftentimes that leads to them being in the hospital more, you know, not being able to spend time at home, and so on and so forth. But in some instances, it can help, because the treatment itself is helping to alleviate some of the symptoms that patients are experiencing. You know, maybe it's helping to keep the tumors under control, or it's helping with some of the symptoms we're going to talk about today in terms of ascites and bowel obstructions and things like that. So I think being able to have that conversation between the palliative care team, the oncology team, and the patient to figure out what is the best course of action is really important. Because the oncologist, you know, has a very clear course of action for how they want to treat the cancer. The patient has a very clear, you know, idea of how they want to spend their last days, weeks, and months. And then our team will often come in to try and help, you know, navigate that a little bit and try to help negotiate what are the best courses of action for each individual patient in each individual circumstance.
Okay, great. And I imagine that it can sometimes be a balancing act, right? You know, the pros and cons of palliative chemo in the context in which that patient finds herself. So it can be a complicated but necessary and very helpful conversation and decision-making process.
You're so right. I think it's all about knowledge and understanding what the ultimate goal of that treatment is, right? Which just comes down to good communication and clear discussions about what we're going for. Certainly, if there's a benefit to the treatment and it's helping somebody feel better, then we're all for it. But if it's just treatment for the sake of treatment without having a bigger picture, you know, conversation about where we're going and whether it's helpful or not, that's different. And so, you know, it is all about the patient as part of the team and helping to make decisions that are right for you. And everybody has a different set of goals, values, and preferences, which is what makes our job so unique and so interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And then the communication piece being so integral. I'm sure that palliative care physicians and healthcare providers have got to be amongst the best communicators, you know, to ensure that job gets well done. Okay, so we're going to move on to some of those, what we call clinical scenarios. So those complications that patients can experience as a result of the cancer progressing. And I think it's appropriate and helpful for me to share with the listeners an analogy that Dr. Bernardini, the division head of gynecologic program at Princess Margaret, has used. And it's that of a pickle jar. If you imagine that the pickles in the jar are the woman's organs, and the brine that surrounds the pickles is the normal fluid that these organs are bathed in, and they're contained in a jar. Okay, I think I've extended his analogy a little bit by including the jar itself, the glass jar. That would be, you know, the cavity that our organs sit in, so the abdomen or the belly. And if you imagine that in the area of the ovaries, the cancer cells can develop and they multiply and they can become released from the area of the ovaries into that fluid or the brine that's bathing those organs, float around in that fluid so that they can then attached to the next organs or more distant organs. And those cells, when they attach to the organs, have spread, or what we call metastasized. They can also spread to the lining of that body cavity. So let's imagine it's the interior part of the glass jar. And when that happens, for a few reasons, there's an accumulation of fluid within the jar or the body cavity. And that is certainly something that women with ovarian cancer present with from early on in their disease. And certainly they can experience this later on or during and later on during the course of their disease. This is referred to as ascites, this accumulation of fluid. So in if you want to add to that explanation that I tried to get through somewhat smoothly, please feel free. And then if you could, Brevni, if you could tell us in your experience how women with ascites feel and what it is that we can do in order to help them.
That's such an interesting analogy. I've not heard that one before, but when I was listening to it makes so much sense. I'm going to use that one myself. So thank you for that.
Great.
I do see a lot of women who struggle with ascites, and you know the symptoms can vary. So it can be something as, you know, as limited as when I eat, I feel full really quickly. I feel that I can't eat the same amount of food as I used to before, and I feel like my tummy bloats up after I eat. Like I feel really, you know, swollen and bloated. As it progresses, then it can lead to more symptoms. So it might be, you know, I feel nauseous when I eat, or sometimes I even like throw up, or I feel like I'm going to vomit or throw up. It can lead to a really swollen belly. And sometimes that swelling can even extend down into the legs because of the pressure of all of that swelling in the belly and the abdomen can compress on the groin area and sort of disrupt the normal flow of fluid throughout the body. And sometimes you can have pain in the back or pain in the belly related to that swelling, because you can imagine if your tummy is really distended and swollen, you're sort of holding yourself in a different way. It's not easy to stand up straight. It's not easy to get out of a chair. But this obviously doesn't happen overnight. It's something that generally happens gradually over time. And sometimes you can even feel short of breath with that, because the fluid is pushing upwards on the diaphragm and it's impacting your lungs' ability to expand broadly when you take a deep breath. So things like going up the stairs or, you know, exerting yourself can be a little bit harder because of that extra fluid that you're carrying around.
Right. And so what can we do for women that are experiencing these types of symptoms due to the buildup of fluid?
So, I mean, first of all, sometimes the treatment itself can help to shrink down this fluid, because like you said, these are cancer cells that are in the brine of the belly. And so sometimes your chemotherapy or your treatment that's prescribed by the oncology team, when that's working well, that's helping to shrink down the amount of cancer cells. So that's one thing. You can prescribe medications that can sometimes help with that feeling of bloating and being full when you eat. Sometimes these are anti-nausea medications that also work directly on the stomach to sort of help the natural movement of food through the gut and through the bowel. And we'll talk a little bit about those later on too in a different context. But when the fluid is really building up and is really bothersome, there are procedures that we can do to actually drain that fluid off. And it usually involves taking an ultrasound and finding, you know, putting the ultrasound on the belly and finding, you know, where the fluid is relative to the other organs in the belly. So the colon, the liver, the kidneys and whatnot, and finding a pocket of fluid where you can insert a needle, just a very small needle that just goes in under the skin into that brine. And draining that fluid off. And often, you know, it can be so surprising. Often you can drain liters and liters and liters of fluid, and you just see the tummy really reducing back down again, which can give enormous, you know, relief and support to patients when they have that drained off. They feel great. It takes a little bit of time for everything to kind of settle back into its normal position, because when you're full of fluid, everything is sort of floating around in a different way to normal, but usually that can be really successful. It can really help to keep that fluid under control. And sometimes we need to do that procedure over and over again. And sometimes we even do it so often that it becomes more advantageous to put in a more permanent drain, which means you don't have to come to the hospital and have the needle put in every single time. There's a small tube or piece of plastic tubing that can be inserted just under the skin into that area of the abdomen, which is clamped on the outside. And so you can have a nurse come to your home, or you can have this done in the clinic where we attach a drainage bag to that tubing, which connects the inside to the outside and allows us to drain off that fluid in a more regular way, and which is easier for patients than coming to and from the hospital and having to have that done a lot. But it can give a lot of relief and can be really helpful.
Okay. Some of the listeners may have had an intraperitoneal catheter placed, so they may understand a little bit about the procedure where the area is frozen before needles put in, and then the tube, that small little piece of plastic, is inserted with and then clamped off or closed off. So that's actually maybe it's nice that it's not altogether and unknown for some patients with ovarian cancer. Yeah. And so when the tube is there, that catheter, we call it, does it hurt? Is it uncomfortable? Or do women usually tolerate it pretty well?
You know, I think when it's put in first, of course, it's a little bit uncomfortable because it's something new and it's something different. And, you know, there's a little bit of maneuvering to get it put in the first place. There's a small cut made in the skin to insert that tubing into the abdomen. But, you know, usually within a few days, that sort of acute intent, that immediate pain is gone, that procedural pain. And then after that, most people really don't feel any discomfort from it at all. And it's just, for most people, the sort of the benefits of it in terms of having the flexibility to having smaller amounts of fluid drained off more frequently, rather than having to maybe wait, you know, several days to come to the hospital, get an appointment to do it. Plus all of the other kind of challenges of coming to the hospital, just the convenience and, you know, parking and whatnot. So for many people, it's really well tolerated and is not just uncomfortable, or certainly not something that some plain Tylenol or just a simple painkiller wouldn't be able to help if you needed it.
Okay, great. So good to know that it can be done at home. So we talked about the fluid accumulating in the belly or the abdominal cavity and the pelvis. And the fluid can also cross the diaphragm. You mentioned the diaphragm, so that flat organ that separates the chest from the belly, and it can, what we say, we it seeds that space, which is a space between a double lining of the lung, and it can also accumulate there, similar to its accumulation in the belly. Symptoms may be similar, especially in terms of the difficulty breathing, I would imagine.
Yeah. So often, again, it starts off a little bit more vague, right? So you might find somebody says, gee, I can't walk up a full flight of stairs, and I start to get a little bit short of breath. Or, you know, I can't walk as far as I used to with my friend when we go out for our brisk walks. And that the exercise tolerance when you're exerting yourself is maybe not the same as it was before. And that can get progressively worse, maybe needing to stop more regularly to catch your breath, maybe having a little bit of discomfort in the chest, or maybe sometimes a little bit of coughing, although not very often. But those are usually the symptoms, feeling a little bit more short of breath that's getting progressively worse over time.
Okay. And then I guess it would be relatively easily diagnosed or picked up by way of a simple X-ray, for example. Okay.
Absolutely. So and then, an X-ray can show us, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And in terms of management, would be similar to the draining off of fluid from the belly?
Yeah. So in the same way that we can pop a needle into the belly and drain off the fluid, we can do the same thing in the chest. And same idea is that we usually use an ultrasound probe just to show us exactly where the safe place to put the needle is, because we don't want to go too far and hit the lung tissue. And there's lots of nerves and ribs, obviously, in that area too. So wanting to be very specific where we're going. And again, this is done in the hospital, but it's done as a day procedure. So you don't have to stay overnight. You're not, you know, put asleep or anything like that. It's all done under local anesthetic. And it makes, you know, again, can make a huge difference. And just like in the belly, where we can put in that permanent tube or drain, we can do the same in the chest if it's something that's happening over and over again and is causing, you know, more frequent need for drainage, we can put in that permanent drain.
Great. All right. So I think we've covered the accumulation of fluid problem. And let's talk about blockage of the tubes that drain the kidneys. Why does this occur and how can we manage that problem?
Yeah, so again, something that we see commonly with ovarian cancer, and going back to your pickles and your brine analogy. So, you know, you can get, so you've got your kidneys and then you've got your bladder, and there's a tube that connects each kidney down to the bladder. And sometimes you can get pressure or blockage or obstruction of those tubes that connect the kidneys to the bladder by like those spots of cancer that are in the lining of the stomach, or sometimes by the fluid that we talked about earlier on, which is heavy when it's bearing down on some of these very tiny tubes in the body. So it's not that the cancer is in the kidneys themselves, it's that there's pressure from the outside that's pushing down on those tubes and stopping the kidneys from emptying and clearing properly. And, you know, sometimes people don't even know that this is a problem, right? It's something that we see on a CT scan, or we do your routine blood work and all of a sudden we realize that your kidneys are not working as well as they were in the past or as they should be. So sometimes there are no symptoms, you know, aside from some of the other things we spoke about. Or sometimes people have, you know, issues where they're peeing less, or they're maybe needing to go to the washroom more often, but passing smaller amounts each time. Or maybe having symptoms that you might think are related to a bladder infection, you know, like a bit of discomfort or a bit of pain in the back, or, you know, something like that. Okay. And so those are sometimes the things that we look for when we're concerned about those symptoms, or somebody's presenting with those symptoms.
All right. And can you explain how we might manage, apart from providing chemotherapy, you know, if appropriate in that scenario, to decrease the load of cancer cells in the area? How can we manage the blockage of those tubes that drain the kidney?
So this is a little bit more of an invasive procedure than some of the things we talked about earlier on, because the kidneys are like deep inside in the body. So it's not easy to just stick a needle in and drain off the fluid in the way we talked about for the ascites and for the pleural effusions. Usually we need to go in and put what's called a stent. So something that just keeps those tubes between the kidneys and the bladder open, a little bit like a straw in a way that kind of goes on the inside and just holds them open and stops that external pressure from the outside from squishing them. Sometimes those stents can be put completely internalized, so you can't see them at all, and they're sitting in between the kidney and the bladder. But more often they're an external tube, so they're, instead of going into that tube between the kidney and the bladder, they're now draining from the kidney out to the outside of the skin, and they're connected to a drainage bag where your urine now collects. So it's collecting urine in a different way, and that's called a nephrostomy tube. So it's bypassing where that blockage is, but still making sure that the kidneys are doing their job and able to filter your urine, and that you're able to pass your urine, your pee as normal a way as possible, but not necessarily passing it in the regular way, but it's being collected in a drainage bag instead.
Right. And so this happens at home, obviously. You're living at home with these tubes draining above the area of the blockage, filling up bags, presumably. And then would a nurse come to the home to monitor how you're doing with that system?
100%. So again, because this is a procedure that's done, so we need to make sure that those tubes are staying in the right place. They usually have a dressing that's over them to keep them, you know, stuck down and close to the skin and prevent them from getting infected. So you will have a nurse who's coming regularly to the home, and then patients themselves are taught how to empty those drainage bags and just make sure that everything is working well, and usually given a phone number to call if they do have any difficulties or any questions about the tubes, or if they become, you know, dislodged or whatnot.
Okay. Okay, great. The last of our specific scenarios, I thought we should talk about the blockage of the bowel. So we talked about blockage of the tubes that drain the kidneys. What about blockage of the bowels? Does that occur very often? And when it does, what do women complain of when they present with this?
Yeah, so it does occur pretty often in patients with ovarian cancer. And we're back again to our brine and our pickle analogy, where the brine is compressing the bowel. So the bowel is like a big, long tube, like a hose, right, that goes from one end of the body to the other. So it's quite soft. It's quite easy to compress that from the outside in. Mm-hmm. When that's compressed or there's pressure on it, it means that your stool, your poo, is not just moving normally through the bowel in the normal way, and it's harder to go to the washroom. So some of the symptoms that people will complain of will depend how high or how low in the bowel that is. If it's higher up, close to the stomach, then you'll often have things like, I eat and I vomit straight away. So I'm vomiting up undigested food. The food is not going down because there's this blockage that's preventing the normal movement of food and material through my gut. Again, you might feel bloated more often, might be constipated, having a hard time going to the washroom. And that might even be passing gas is difficult. So you just don't feel like anything is moving, that everything is very slowed up and stuck. So again, yeah, you can have that bloating feeling in the stomach, and really having very low appetite, you know, really not interested in eating. And again, eating and feeling sick very, very quickly and vomiting up, you know, really undigested food. So just exactly what you've eaten is coming back up again in the same form that you took it down.
Right. Okay. Okay. I remember going through some of that after I had surgery, and it was very unpleasant. I wouldn't, you know, I was managed very well and quickly, it was recognized quickly, so that as soon as the specific measures were put in place to help me, then I started feeling much better, that's for sure. So do you want to go over some of the measures that can be put in place to help people that suffer from this?
Yeah, so I think first of all, telling patients up front that this can happen and just being aware that this is a possibility is so important, because often we can pick up some of these subtle signs before they progress to being a full-on bowel obstruction, which you can attest to is really unpleasant. So yeah, things like being really vigilant around your bowels and making sure that they're moving regularly. And if they're not moving regularly, usually there's a phone number where you can call and speak to a nurse to kind of get some advice or to provide some feedback. Because our ultimate goal is to try and prevent this from happening or pick it up in the early stages rather than leaving it progress. Because if it does progress and somebody is vomiting, they're not keeping anything down, they're not going to the washroom, well, then usually this is one of those awful scenarios where we do have to send you to the emergency room, right? Because it is something that's more serious and that can't usually be managed at home. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do in that instance is we want to give your gut a little bit of a chance to rest, to recuperate and to heal. So you'll sometimes see us put a tube that goes from the nose down into the stomach. That's called a nasogastric tube. And what mm-hmm. that's doing is we would call decompress the stomach, right? So it's draining all of the food, all of the acid, all of the liquid that sits in your stomach that you would now be vomiting because there's nowhere for it to go. So it's going to drain that into a bag external to you again.
Yeah.
We put you on an intravenous for fluid to keep hydrated and make sure that you know you're not trying to drink and then vomiting that up and feeling wretched. And mm-hmm. Usually we give you something for nausea if that's a problem. Again, we give that intravenously rather than by mouth, because anything you're taking by mouth isn't really working, right? Because it's not being digested and absorbed in the right way. The good news is we usually don't have to resort to surgery. Usually just like resting the stomach and the bowel and just giving you hydration, giving you some of these medications like steroids that help to reduce some of the swelling that can happen in the bowel when it's compressed, can just rest and can make things much, much better. And it usually resolves spontaneously. But in some instances, it doesn't, and it becomes more of a chronic issue, in which case, again, we're back to tubes and drainage bags, where sometimes we actually have to put in what's called a gastrostomy tube, which is a more permanent bypass procedure that allows you to eat, but that then everything that you eat is going to be coming out into this drainage bag. So rather than having that tube down the nose, there's an alternative way of decompressing the stomach that's more of a permanent procedure.
Okay, Brevni, can you expand a little bit more on why and how that gastrostomy helps in these situations?
Sure. So like I said, initially we'll pop that tube from the nose down into the stomach.
Okay.
You can imagine that's not the most pleasant thing to have done, right? It's uncomfortable. It often gets dislodged and it falls out, and it's really unpleasant to have to keep putting it in and out, even though it's serving a really important purpose, which is decompressing and emptying the stomach of all of this material that has nowhere else to go while your bowel is resting and recovering.
Right.
So let's say there's a scenario where, you know, this is prolonged for a period of time and it's not something that resolves within a short number of days. Then sometimes we recommend what's called a venting gastrostomy tube, which is basically the same idea, a procedure that will decompress the stomach, but it's doing it directly from the stomach outwards into a drainage bag rather than all having to come up through this tube via the nose, which is unsightly and uncomfortable and unpleasant.
Okay. Okay. All right. While the bowel is resting, and which may be a long time in some cases. Okay. I understand. All right. And in some situations, speaking of which, if it's a prolonged period of time, do you see some women with ovarian cancer requiring nutrition given into the veins?
We do sometimes, yeah, especially if this is a prolonged bowel obstruction, but, you know, you're still continuing with treatment and there's still a hope that this will resolve. Of course, we want to make sure that you're getting adequate nutrition. Giving intravenous fluids is okay in the short term. That replaces, you know, most of your electrolytes and what you need, but it's not calories. So it's not replacing your day-to-day nutritional requirements. And while our goal is always to have people eating by mouth and eating normally, because that's the most natural way of getting your nutrition, if that's not working for you and it's going to be delayed for a period of time because of what's going on in your gut, sometimes we do give what's called TPN or total parenteral nutrition, which is nutrition that's given intravenously or given sometimes through different tubes to replace what you should be taking and your nutritional requirements temporarily.
Okay. All right. Thanks for explaining that. So we'll move on from specific clinical complications to these general symptoms that many of us have experienced, which may become progressive as one approaches end stages of life. And things like fatigue, but increasing fatigue, increasing weakness, an inability to think clearly, the hunger issue, which you have mentioned a few times, the inability to eat and even the desire to eat. Apart from what you've already explained, are there other reasons why these symptoms may occur? And is there something that we can do to help women who are suffering from these kinds of complaints?
Yeah, like these are really common symptoms, as you said, when somebody's entering a different phase of the illness where maybe things are more advanced and perhaps coming closer to the end of life. And I think it's important to remember that the cancer, of course, isn't just staying in one spot at this time. We're not just talking about the pickle and the brine anymore. We're talking about cancer cells that are really circulating throughout the body. And so there's this constant tension between your normal body habits and routines and these cancer cells that are now, you know, juggling for attention and juggling for energy and using up a lot of those energy stores that you normally have. And this is why, you know, when somebody has advanced cancer and is very sick, they often look very thin and very gaunt, right? Even though they might be eating and they might be doing many of the things that they normally do, but they're in what we call a catabolic state where, you know, your body's own energy stores are being, you know, sucked up and being used sometimes by these cancer cells faster than you're producing them. So, you know, it's this constant utilization of your own natural energy sources, which causes you to lose your appetite, be more tired, need to rest more, maybe not feel like you're thinking as clearly and as sharply as you normally do, losing weight like we talked about, And even some other things, like sometimes it can cause psychological distress, like it can cause people to feel depressed or anxious, which on the one hand is a normal part of dealing with a serious illness. But there's some really interesting evidence and research that's showing us that some of this is actually driven by the cancer cells itself, independent of, you know, the normal, you know, I'm feeling upset about my health, but there's something physiological about the cancer cells, or these cytokines, as we call them, that are predisposing you to feel depressed, anxious, stressed, and worried above and beyond what's a normal level of concern at this stage.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that before. You mentioned that more recent research has suggested that maybe the cancer itself produces some factors that independently cause a feeling of being down or sad in people with this disease, like independent of a reaction, which is normal, of feeling sad about it. And it reminds me that, I don't know if this was related or not, but when I went through chemotherapy a second time, I felt a sadness and a downness that, I thought, is this specifically this chemo, which was slightly different than the first? And I suspected that it had something to do with the chemo above and beyond just the situation that I found myself in again. And I didn't really share it with anybody, but I wonder if, you know, in the future, we'll be able to understand more and more about this kind of phenomenon.
I hope so. You know, I feel like this is the last frontier when it comes to cancer and how we approach patients with cancer, that we're getting better and better at detecting cancer, at treating cancer, at coming up with physical symptom management. But we're still not very good at asking people about their mental health and their coping and the psychological side of cancer. Certainly better than we were in the past, but I still feel that we've got a ways to go in terms of incorporating that into our regular assessments about how patients are. And more when I ask patients in my practice and I try to normalize it and share what I just shared with you, you know, more and more people say, yeah, I feel that way. And I thought it was just me, or I thought maybe I'm just not strong enough, or I'm just not coping well enough. And, you know, I look at everybody else in the chemo day unit and they all seem, you know, so upbeat and they all seem to be coping so well. And am I the only one who feels this way? And it can be a very lonely place, I think, you know, to be going through cancer in the first instance, but then to feel depressed and to feel sad and not to have a space to talk about that, I think is really something we need to work on.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure we'll talk about that some more in the second second episode of this series. All right. So why can we talk about the last, you know, few weeks or even days before a patient dies of their disease? So that part of the dying process. How does a woman and her family and friends, how do we know when that time is coming? Is there, apart from, you know, a physician maybe identifying it, or a nurse, of course, what would be the signs that something has definitely changed in terms of the tempo and where we're at in the course of this disease?
Such a great question. I mean, I think often people intuitively know themselves when there's a change in their health, right? Something is different. Maybe you're just not bouncing back after treatment as quickly as you used to do before. You're spending more time resting. Your energy levels are just not as they were. Despite resting a lot more, you're not feeling energized. You're not feeling rejuvenated afterwards. The things we talked about earlier on, like your appetite diminishing, all of those things, when they're consistent and when they're sort of in a steady decline, are signs for us that we're really entering a different phase of the illness. And of course, sometimes that can happen in the context of an infection or something reversible. But when we've ruled all of those things out and when things are steadily declining, it's on us to have those conversations. But often, you know, patients will say, no, I think things are changing, you know, and oftentimes I think patients and their families recognize that themselves, often sometimes faster than we do as the healthcare team, right? Because they're more tuned into their bodies and they see the day-to-day things that are happening at home that we don't see in the hospital setting.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think that that's what it is. I think that similar to this situation where we need to be in tune with what's going on with us or our loved one. In those other situations you were talking about too, we need to be in tune and we need to listen to our bodies. I think perhaps maybe not at the very end stage of life, but throughout the course of our illness, it's really important to be mindful of how we're feeling and trying not to pass it off. It's just a fleeting something or other. I think that does us well to really listen to our bodies when we're going through this type of thing.
100%.
Yeah. So in those last days, then what assuming that these feelings have been shared with the care providers, including the palliative care team, what would the goals of treatment be for someone like yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, the goal at this point is to make sure that our patients are feeling comfortable, that they're where they want to be. So for many people, that's at home in their own house, but for other people, maybe not. Maybe it's in a hospice or a palliative care unit or a more of a clinical setting where you've got access to doctors and nurses around the clock. But ideally, we would have had these conversations throughout the illness. This isn't something that we like to just land on at the very last minute, because first of all, we like to have the time and space, as we said earlier on, to work through these, but also people change their minds. So something that you said to me 3 months ago, 6 months ago, may not apply anymore, depending on how you're feeling, what's going on with your health, the symptoms you're experiencing, and also the people you have around you and how they are coping with this. Because, a lot of care at the end of life does fall on friends, family, and loved ones. So just as we have to recognize this for our patients, we also have to have, time and space to talk with caregivers, family, friends, loved ones who will be rallying around somebody as they're coming to the end of life to make sure that they are mentally and physically prepared for what they're going into at this stage, which is often a lot of hands-on care, administering medications, doing a lot of really kind of medical tasks that let's face it, we don't often prepare families for in anticipation of this, and making sure, as we've said throughout, that they feel empowered, that they know who to call, that they have connections, that we have made referrals to community resources, to have nurses come to the home, to have personal support workers who are folks who can help with bathing and changing and turning and dressing and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. If there's any equipment that somebody needs at home, sometimes somebody will benefit from a hospital bed with a special pressure relieving mattress or, different things to help them feel more comfortable. That we're working on that in the background and making sure that whatever we can provide at home or wherever it is that our patients are, to make them feel as comfortable as possible, that we're doing that, and we're doing that in a proactive way rather than waiting for things to become very chaotic and, frantic.
Yeah. I, personally, I know that if I'm feeling a little bit frazzled myself, then I make mistakes or I find it really difficult to make a decision, and that can be even with small-ish things. So I also know that when you're in a very, a serious situation like this, where they're very important decisions to make, if you have the time, as you said, to make them calmly and to consult the people around you, that's definitely the best way to go. And yeah. You talked about where patients may want to spend their last days, or where women might want to spend their last days, and we've got home, hospital, hospice as well. The home might be a long-term care facility, in certain situations, or some other kind of facility. And you mentioned that it might be a personal decision. Are there issues accessing hospice sometimes if a patient decides that home isn't quite best place, but hospital isn't either? Sometimes I see that as a good in-between type place. How does that work?
So, I mean, I feel like the message of the day has been do things early and think about it ahead of time, because like with everything in life, preparation is key, right? We're really fortunate in Ontario and in Toronto that we have a lot of hospice beds. I mean, we could always do with more, but we have hospice beds and we have access to hospice beds. And usually when somebody's at home, if they need to be admitted to hospice, usually we can get them admitted within a short space of time, usually within a short number of days. And our goal is always to try and keep patients out of the emergency department, as much as possible, because as great as our emergency departments are and the folks who work there are phenomenal, it is not necessarily the right place to be for somebody as they're coming to the end of life. And so when I'm having conversations with women about where they would like to be at the end of life, usually they say at home, but we always sort of put a little asterisk that says, if I can't be at home, where would be my number two, right? And that's where we talk about hospice. And sometimes I'll even encourage them to consider the different hospice units in their local area. And we often provide them with a list and say, okay, so you live in this part of town, here are the hospices that are in your local area. Sometimes people even want to go and visit just in case it might be somewhere they need to go at the end of life. And again, just feeling empowered that that is the right place for them to be, that they would be comfortable there, that their family would feel supported there. And it is possible to kind of have your name on a backup list for a hospice or a palliative care unit should you need it in the future. It's not like long-term care where there are long, long waiting lists and it's a very onerous process to get admitted there, thankfully. It's usually a much more straightforward process. But part of our job is to sort of go through the different, you know, permutations and combinations and say, well, if not home, then where? And to sort of have that conversation up front so that, again, we can start working on that as soon as possible if that is something that that one of our patients needs.
Okay, great. So it sounds like then the options of being at home or in a hospice are good options for many, and that the supports are definitely there, whether you're at home or in hospital in your final days. So that's good, I think, for people to know. Did you want to add anything else before we end our session today?
Well, just to speak briefly about home for one last minute is, you know, home is amazing and home is where most of us would like to be, I think, all things being equal. But it's really not possible for us to replicate that hospice environment with doctors and nurses 24 hours a day in the home setting. And I think that's where I was going when I was saying that a lot of care falls on family members when somebody's at home, which for some patients is perfect because, you know, it's straightforward and their care needs are not enormous. But if care needs are more complex, if we have a lot of these drains and tubes that we talked about earlier on, or they're having a bowel obstruction, or there's something else going on, then home may not be the right place for them to be. And even though somebody might have said to us, that's really where I want to be, you know, I think sometimes we have to accept that in the interest of their safety and giving them the best possible care, that sometimes we have to compromise and maybe make a decision and try to make their hospice room as homely as possible by having all of the people there, but able to focus on being your family members rather than being, you know, your doctor, your nurse, your physio, your pharmacist, and having to take on all of those medical tasks.
Yeah. It can be very, very onerous for family members, as you well know. So it's, again, as you said, it all leads back to that initial statements that you've made, is that if the palliative care team is involved early on, then these kinds of things are covered off and then revisited again as necessary so that the right decisions are made. Yeah, great. I feel like we've covered a lot in this short period of time, but I think that these have been what I thought were the most important issues to discuss. It's at least a starting point for women as they go through this journey with ovarian cancer. And I think that, you know, many women have fear of the unknown. And by casting a little bit of light on these topics, there's a little less fear as some of us progress through our journey with this disease. I wanted to thank you so much, really, for being our guest today. As always, I've found that the experts that we have on this podcast from Princess Margaret are always so professional and so, at the same time, very warm and so engaged and just really great at explaining, you know, what it is that patients with ovarian cancer need to know. And I'm really, really grateful. And I hope to speak with you again sometime.
Thank you so much.
Take care.